Hello. Welcome to Audio One of Discovery-Orientated Conversational Process, inspired by Janella Bird. I am Josephine Stanton. The text of this audio is on the website talkthatheals.org. The mission behind the website and these audio recordings is to make clinicians and therapists aware of the possibilities Janella's work offers. This audio includes an introduction, 5 strategies to try, and a bit of background. Tanya Windelborn and I began this project because we found that even just beginning to learn Janella's approach, we noticed an added freshness and interest to our clinical work. People seemed to find us more helpful. Sadly, Tanya passed in 2023, but the project continues to evolve. Including audios is a new development to make the idea more accessible to people who would rather listen than read. I would greatly appreciate any feedback on the website and podcasts. Please email info@talkthatheals.org. info@talkthatheals.org. Now to Janella's work. Like the perfect golf swing or the perfect tennis shot, Janella's work looks simple and not hard to do. Her therapeutic conversations appear ordinary, but they can be transformational. The difference is felt rather than heard. Conversation focuses on the resource and agency of the people we are working with. They open space for people to feel listened to, experience, and hear themselves differently and find possibilities for movement. What is offered here, in these podcasts and on the website, is a taster, an invitation to explore. Much more can be found in Janella's books, DVDs, and website. You can access this by searching her name, Janella Bird, J-O-H-N-E-L-L-A Bird, B-I-R-D. I am beginning with 5 strategies to try. This is because the focus in this approach is on practice, the craft and what we actually do. The theory supporting it is complex, but these strategies are tools you can try to put a toe in the water, to begin to get an idea if you want to go further with this. The first strategy is consciously to remind yourself that this person negotiates a life we have little understanding of and uses skills, knowledge, and resources we want to learn about. As you ask a question, ready yourself to listen to the answer, looking for wisdom and open to hearing what you don't expect. Asking a question with the aim of bringing forward resources of the people we are working with is a different activity from asking a question to elicit information for us to process. Think of asking someone who has made an obvious blunder. What was the process you went through to come up with that solution? We are wondering how they could have gone so far off track, identifying a deficit. Compare this with asking the same question of someone who has found a creative solution to a challenging situation. What was the process you went through to come up with that solution? You are hoping to learn something which might help you. The second orientation is how we are wanting to approach the people who come to see us. I noticed an example of this contrast from my own life. When my children were little, I had a friend whose children were a bit older than mine. I really admired her parenting. I would often ask her things like, "What did you do about pocket money? How would you decide if the children could go and stay over with someone?" The purpose of these questions was to elicit wisdom, ideas which I thought might help me in my parenting decisions. The conversation was based on the respect I had for the parenting I saw my friend doing. It struck me one day at work in a clinical interview that my questions were focused totally differently. I was looking for what parents were doing wrong, gaps in their parenting capacities that I could help with. Engaging someone in a collaborative discovery conversation entails the assumption that the resources they have will be not just helpful, but essential in making the shifts they want in their lives. These resources are often not available in conscious awareness. The discovery process has the potential to bring forward the resources and make them explicit. This is in stark contrast to the deficit focus so common in ordinary thinking, particularly social and other media, and much professional thinking. The second strategy is to prioritise asking people for their thoughts and ideas over sharing ours. If we have a recommendation to give or some information we want to offer, we can try asking the person about it. For example, if we want to recommend exercise, we could say, "Lots of people find exercises helpful. Do you think it will be helpful for you?" Or in engaging people in the idea of learning emotion regulation skills, "Do you have strategies for getting through and easing strong emotions? Would you like to hear about some that other people use?" Asking rather than telling is a deceptively simple countercultural shift to practice. If we ask a question in a way which puts into practice the respect we have for people's views, they will feel that respect. In answering, they may surprise themselves as well as us. In an adaptation of the words of E.M. Forster, "How do I know what I know until I hear what I say?" Asking a question has another great advantage of being low risk if we are not getting it right. If we suggest a change in behaviour which doesn't fit with the person's capacity, ideology, or values, they often experience this as unhelpful, even though they may well not tell us. However, if we ask them what it would be like for them to do this in an attitude of exploration, we may all learn about the capacities, ideology, and values which guide their lives. More examples could be, "What sort of things have you tried or thought about trying? Are increasing social contact or looking for a job things you have considered? Is bringing these concerns up directly with your boss an option you would consider?" Similarly, for ideas we have about how to make sense of what is happening in their lives, asking about what a person thinks about an idea has the possibility of stimulating their thinking with limited risk around getting it wrong. The role of the power dynamic in a therapeutic relationship adds a lot of complexity to this, but I'll come back to that later. When we want to offer ideas or information, we can actively seek feedback. You are describing a strong emotional response in these interactions with your partner. Do you think the intensity of the response you have is partly due to old feelings left over from the abuse you experienced as a child? What comes up in your thoughts and feelings when I'm making that suggestion? My telling you about what a limited strategy telling is, I need to acknowledge, a limited strategy. But I am hoping that by experimenting with these strategies, you might notice something. I would also like to ask you two questions and ask you to notice any difference in the experiences you have as you hear them. The first question is what you are hearing in this podcast making sense? The second question is, what is coming up in your thoughts and feelings as you are hearing me talk? I have found when I am choosing to do telling that the question, what is coming up in your thoughts and feelings, has a better chance of eliciting tentative responses people have than, am I making sense? Was this true for you? The third strategy is to ask for feedback as you go along. For example, I would like to stop you for a minute and check if you're finding this conversation helpful. Can I just check, are we talking about the right stuff? You may get some surprises, I certainly have. During my training, I saw an adolescent who came to appointments, but I never felt I engaged with her effectively. About a month after I had moved to another placement, she came in specially to thank me. She asked the staff to tell me that she did not know how she would have got through that term at school without coming to see me. I was mystified. I have also had the converse experience of feeling specially pleased with the work I was doing with someone, only to find later that that was not how that had seemed to them. The earlier we can get this sort of information, the better. The process of asking for feedback demonstrates an interest in and a respect for the person. It can be surprisingly helpful and surprisingly difficult to remember to do. When I do remember to do it, I usually find it brings a pause and sometimes an unexpected and very useful answer. An example of this happened in a conversation with a young woman and her father about the low mood and lack of motivation she was struggling with. I asked if we were talking about the right stuff. They stopped, looked at each other and said no. What they both agreed we needed to be talking about was the amount of marijuana she was smoking. In this context, switching the focus to marijuana made good sense to me, but where we have a different idea, this may be an area for further discovery or negotiation. Well, that is really interesting. I didn't realise that. Thank you for telling me. Can you help me understand how you have figured that out? Or what are you hoping for in a conversation about X? Is Y something you would like to come back to later, or is it not of interest to you? When we feel a conversation is not going well, eliciting feedback can give a welcome opportunity for reflection and possible refocusing. When we have a high level of certainty that we are on the button and doing something useful, eliciting feedback about how the other person is experiencing the conversation can be even more important. Our certainty could reduce the sensitivity we have to picking up on tentative doubts in the other person. There is a risk of sweeping them along with our enthusiasm in a direction which may not be so helpful. When someone is venting, it can be particularly helpful to ask them if they are finding the conversation useful. Some people report venting being particularly useful at times, although it can use a lot of time going over the same ground. Enabling someone to pause and reflect can require significant assertiveness in this context. Sitting forward and a hand gesture can help. Can we stop for a moment? I just want to check in. Are you finding this conversation helpful? If you are, that is great. I am more than happy to be here and be part of it. Let me know if you notice it not being useful anymore. I would also like to check in with you again. Would that be okay? We may need to provide support to enable people to give feedback. In the socio-cultural environment we operate in, there is an underlying expectation that we are the experts, there to draw on the knowledge and skills we hold. This frame does not support people to bring their thoughts and responses forward. Particularly if they only have a tentative or half-formed idea, they may well not let us know, even if we ask, full stop. Making explicit anything we notice in the room can help. For example, I noticed a very quick yes without much time to consider. If you did have a sense that we need to shift the focus of the conversation, how easy would it be to let me know? Would there be some worry about the need to be polite or worry about hurting my feelings? I noticed some change of expressions on your face and some looking around. What did you notice in your thoughts and feelings when I asked you that? I noticed in the beginning of the conversation you seemed to be talking more freely than you are now. Has something I've said made it less easy to talk? Are you noticing some judgment or criticism? In a family context, another family member can be helpful. For example, do you think that Marianne would tell me if she wasn't finding this helpful? How likely would she be to feel able to say that, or would she be likely to just go along? Would you be able to tell by her expression or body language? These conversations are potentially risk with discovery opportunity around issues which are not only important for the therapeutic process, but also for negotiating any relationship. The fourth strategy is to focus on agency. When hearing about traumatic events or overwhelming hardship, it is natural to offer empathy, to acknowledge and validate how hard it must have been. But we can also explore the agency and resources the person drew on to survive. We can ask about what the person did or is doing, how they approached the situation. That certainly sounds tough. How did you get through? What kept you going in the face of all that? Early in my career, the recommendation was made that people be described as survivors rather than victims of trauma, a simple linguistic maneuver to support agency. This is a start. We can do a lot more by engaging people in a collaborative discovery process, exploring the detail of how they got through, what support was available, and how they were able to make use of that support. This can be personally affirming and bring into conscious awareness resources which could be useful in their current lives. People use a vast range of strategies. Dissociation or cutting off part of their awareness is common. Many people maintain ongoing vigilance, actively looking out for a hint of a slight or untrustworthiness in others. Some limit the interpersonal contacts they have in their lives. Some people focus on protecting younger siblings, taking up adult roles in their families, or avoiding vulnerability and dependence on others. It is easy to pathologize these strategies, but we can also explore them as choices which they have made and used agency to engage in. This is an example I have made up, drawing on my experience of many real conversations with mothers struggling to parent against the odds. Therapist: they sound like grueling times. What kept you going? Mum: the kids. I would not abandon my kids. I get stoned every night when they are in bed, but I am always there for them during the day. Therapist: the determination you describe to be there for your kids, where in your life did you learn that determination? Mum: no one was ever there for me. I hated that and I did not want that for my kids. Therapist: I'm really interested in that. You can imagine someone saying, no one was there for me, how could I be there for my kids? But you are not saying that. You are saying that what you have taken from that experience of not having people there for you is a determination to be there for your kids, to make it different for them. There are many possibilities for exploration. Some possible next directions could be: how does this determination to be there for your kids show itself in everyday life? How do you manage to get through the days without using marijuana? What or who supports you with that? Asking for feedback is important. Specifically, we need to check explicitly for any judgment she is experiencing in the conversation. The fifth strategy relates to when we notice judgment coming up in ourselves. The fifth strategy relates to when we notice judgment coming up in ourselves. Before I met Janella, my response to myself experiencing judgment was to shut down that response and note a problem which might be returned to. Shutting down the response is obviously preferable to expressing judgment, but it can also mean a missed opportunity. When judgment comes up for me, I'm noticing something. This something, which I cannot name in the moment, may be an opportunity for exploration. It is possible that in experiencing the judgment, something of significance in my life is being triggered. I may need to address that in another context. But an inquiry made from a position of profound respectfulness carries low risk of harm to the conversation, and I might be surprised. When I had not long been working on learning Janella's approach, I met a woman seeking help for her son, who was about 11. He did not want to be in the room, and she suggested he go to the shop and buy a drink. She gave him some money, and what followed was a complex conversation about what he was to do with the change. He appeared a little agitated at times. I noticed judgment coming up in myself, something like, this woman cannot set a limit. Ideas of how to upskill her in limit setting started to form in my mind. However, thinking of Janella's instruction to hold the judgment and make an inquiry, I asked her about how she managed money issues like this. I was surprised. The complexity and sensitivity of her thinking about it filled me with admiration. I had nothing to teach her about managing limits with her son. I find it useful to have doc questions which come easily to mind, such as, is that the approach you usually take? How well did that work for you? How did you make that decision? What did you think about? What were the hopes and values that supported the decision you made? In response to a parent lecturing, haranguing, or criticizing a child, how well do you find this works at home? Can be a useful question. I find the parent will often laugh and say, not at all. In response to a negative comment to someone else in the room, what are you hoping Marianne will take from this? Can help a person reflect and bring forward resource. Where someone is describing being in an abusive relationship, it might be helpful to ask, you are describing a lot of hurt and pain from what happens in this relationship. What keeps you there? That is the end of the five strategies to try. I hope they provide, at least, food for thought. The last few minutes of this audio describe some of the context Tanya and I brought to this work. At the time we developed the first version of the website, Tanya and I were working in a fledgling child and adolescent community mental health service in northern New Zealand. There was a lot of poverty and disadvantage, but also a richness of community spirit, cultural heritage, and a commitment to supporting children. 50% of the population were Māori, the indigenous people of New Zealand. Tanya was Māori. Reflecting on it now, I realise that though Tanya and I both grew up in New Zealand, She had grown up in a non-Western Maori world. Conceptualising the world in a more collective relational way came naturally to her. Her professional training was a degree in nursing she had started after having her children. She took to Janella's work like a duck to water, using it creatively in all sorts of contexts. In contrast, I had grown up in a Western individual-focused culture. I trained as a doctor, specialised in psychiatry, and engaged in a range of therapy training. My own family background was somewhat unconventional, but I had a whole lot of indoctrination into cultures and mini-cultures I had to fight my way free of. Tanya was immensely helpful to me in that process. This is one of the many things I miss about her. I am hoping that in my struggles, I have developed some conscious awareness of the challenges I faced, which can be helpful to others. While learning from Janella, I have been working as a psychiatrist. This is a very different context from that as a therapist. Psychiatrists in New Zealand were, and still are, a scarce, expensive resource. My time has always been spread thinly over the people I met. A strong value for me, which comes down the generations, is to be as useful as possible. Core tasks I have had to achieve in my work include diagnostic assessment, managing risk, medication prescribing, and use of the Mental Health Act to support compulsory care. Despite this, I have long held an ideal for every interaction to be a therapeutic interaction. The attention Janella pays to the therapeutic relationship in every conversation and the structure of every sentence was just what I needed. I can bring the awareness of the stance she uses to every conversation. This is the end of Audio One. Thank you for listening.